This is Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway, and we're just days away from the 2018 midterm election. On today's show, we'll give you the final run-through on where the races stand, from the fight for the House and Senate to key governor's races in Georgia and Florida, and we'll end the hour with a look at the polling data and whether we should trust it this time around. And we're hearing from you all this hour about what's at stake in this crucial midterm election.
My name's Jennifer from Chico, California, and I'm very much going to be voting in the midterm elections. I have a lot of council seats available in my city, and so a lot is at stake here.
This is Jeff calling from Ventura, California. I will absolutely be voting in the midterm elections, and I believe everything is at stake, including our democracy.
My name is Zita Rice, and I'm calling from Apalachin, New York. I feel as though there are no longer checks and balances, and there needs to be. No one party should have the ultimate rule.
If you're voting, tell us what you think is at stake in this election. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. We begin this hour with the fight for the House of Representatives. To win control, Democrats need to pick up 23 seats. In my other job at the Cook Political Report, we give Democrats the advantage in winning control of the House. They appear likely to pick up anywhere from 25 to 40 seats, with 30 to 40 seats the most likely. Adley Lapp and Liesl Hickey are hosts of the House Talk podcast, and both are seasoned political operatives and strategists who are heavily involved in many of these battleground districts. Adley says the election of President Trump has changed the electoral map for Democrats.
I've been doing housework for a long time. So has Liesl. We've been looking at the same set of seats year after year after year. And this year, I think because of the kind of campaign that Trump waged and the kind of Republican he is, there were a lot of districts that Hillary Clinton carried that nobody thought she was going to carry. Districts in Orange County, in Texas, et cetera. One of my favorite statistics is that we have 25 Republican-held districts that Hillary Clinton carried. We didn't even have a legitimate Democratic candidate for Congress in those in 2016 in about 12 of them, which just goes to show people thought that those were just not competitive districts. So he really mixed up the map, but then he did better in some districts that had been longtime Democratic strongholds with more blue-collar workers in those districts. And I think what's happened this cycle is that we're competing really well in all of those 25 Hillary Clinton-held districts, but we're also making real inroads in the districts that he won, the districts that do have some Democratic DNA, and we're finding ways to talk to those voters about economics and other pocketbook issues that I think is leading them to want to vote Democratic again.
Liesl, what do you think has changed? And also, I want you to talk specifically about the record number of retirements. I think it's 42 Republicans decided they weren't going to run for re-election, and what role that played in making the House as competitive as it is now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that changed the map a lot. I mean, it made many districts that probably wouldn't have been as competitive very, very competitive. Open seats historically in this sort of cycle, who, especially the ones who didn't vote for the president, you know, historically we've never won one of those, and they always go to the other party. So right there, you put many districts, you know, on the map that shouldn't have been there. So I think retirements were a big thing. I mean, and obviously going into this, history is not on our side. I mean, the president in power, they're going to lose seats in a midterm. I think there have been other factors that have contributed to where we actually are today, where I think there were moments, and I think there was a path to us holding the majority. I think that's gotten pretty tough here in the final weeks. But, you know, we always were going to have some headwinds going into this election.
This election is supposed to be all about Donald Trump, and yet I don't see his name in many ads in these key congressional districts. Why is that?
There's two reasons for that. First of all, the Trump factor is really baked in. If you are a voter who's voting to provide a check on Donald Trump, you know that, and you're voting, you're open to voting for a Democrat. You just have to know that that Democrat is the right kind of Democrat for you. And then secondly, a lot of the playing field are in districts that Donald Trump is still somewhat popular in. His job approval rating may be close to 50 in some of these districts. And we're running against the Republican incumbent in those districts, not necessarily against Trump.
Well, I think you've seen in the suburban districts, Republican incumbents distance from Trump. I mean, they've talked a lot about being independent. They've talked about standing up to the president. They've, you know, mentioned things where they voted against him. So you have seen that in the Hillary Clinton suburban districts. In terms of defining Democrats, I mean, one of the best ways that Republicans can define Democrats is to link them to Nancy Pelosi. Voters know exactly what that means. It doesn't require more explanation, and they don't like her. And so as much as, you know, you hear over and over, oh, here we go again, Republicans are going after Nancy Pelosi, it is because it works. And in a lot of these districts, like Ali had mentioned, where the president is still popular and Nancy Pelosi is very unpopular, it really is our best play. And it allows Republicans to create the clear choice between the candidates. And Pelosi just helps Republicans do that.
Ali, talk about health care, because that's an issue that I see in almost every single ad run by Democrats this year. Why the sort of laser-like focus on that issue?
You know, I think when Republicans brought up the health care bill in 2017, suddenly it really hit home for a lot of voters. And most people know someone or themselves have a pre-existing condition. Lifetime coverage caps really mean something very concrete and real to a lot of voters. And I think, you know, they really did not want to go down the road that Republicans wanted to take them on. And it really is personal for these voters. So I think Democratic candidates are talking about healthcare a lot. I think it'll be a big early push of a Democratic Congress is talking about how do we get healthcare costs under control and make sure everyone has access to really good healthcare.
Lisa, how did we get here? The last, I don't know, feels like forever, elections have been about Obamacare is terrible, Obamacare is terrible, Obamacare is terrible. Republicans have won 3 elections with that message. And now the tables got turned on them.
I know polling will show that healthcare is a driving issue and Democrats believe healthcare is a driving issue. I don't think this election is being won on healthcare. I think Democrats are wrong if they think that. I think this election is about President Trump. And if Republicans lose a majority, it is because it was a referendum on the president. I'm not saying healthcare is not a concern of voters. It absolutely is. But people do want to see reform in action. I don't think they necessarily now are in love with Obamacare.
I think the last time we talked to each other, we talked about how the suburbs were the key to the 2018 election. Ali, is that still the case when we look back the day after the election? Are we going to say that the House majority was really decided by suburban voters?
Well, I don't think Democrats can get to a majority by just winning the suburban voters and the suburban districts. I think it will provide a big chunk of the 23 that we need to get there. And you're seeing, you know, that there's not a single suburban district that Democrats aren't competing heavily in and potentially favored to win in many of those. And that's not always been the case. I mean, I think the biggest change in the suburbs this time versus every other election cycle I've been involved with since 2006 is that no suburban Republican is safe.
You see the same thing, Liesl. You've spent a lot of time working with Republicans in suburban districts, and they've been winning in those districts.
I think the majority absolutely runs through the suburbs. I think we see a suburban realignment, and I think that's where Democrats will pick up most of their seats that get them to 23. It has changed dramatically in these districts over the last year and a half with the president.
And is this all reaction to him? Or do you guys think that this was happening already and he just sort of supercharged it?
In some places, it was happening already. Like there are many districts that are on the 25 Clinton district that had also voted for Obama once or twice. So there were many that were sort of already Democratic lean, moving in that direction. But I think the president, using your words, did sort of supercharge it, and especially with college-educated women. And in suburban races, Republicans were always able to do well with married women and were really struggling with them this cycle.
I want to get your take on the other sort of conventional wisdom from this year that this is really all about women.
Look, there's a huge gender gap, but I think districts have different levels of gender gaps. And in some districts, you have, you know, Republicans voting for the man by plus 10, but Democrats voting for the woman by plus 18. And so that, you know, Democrats going to win that race. There are other districts where the gender gap isn't quite as small. And what I've seen anecdotally is that tends to be the case, oddly enough, particularly in the inner suburbs with higher education and higher income levels, like a Virginia 10, for example. And that's less because Democrats aren't crushing it with women. It's actually because men are voting Democratic there, too.
I see.
But look, I think both parties should really be competing for the votes of both genders. I think it leads to lots of better outcomes. And I think if you see Democrats do particularly poorly with men in some parts of the country, you know, that's something we have to figure out as a party moving forward, too.
And Liesl, if the president were a different person, like his personality were different, okay, and it's we're just really about the policies, would this election look different?
I think so. I mean, that's what's so frustrating for me thinking about this election. It's not an issues-based election. It's just not. And it really is about him personally, like very personally. There are many issues where Republicans are beating Democrats, if it's the economy or spending and taxes and even crime and law and order and national security. I mean, there's a very long list where voters agree with Republicans, trust Republicans more to handle those issues. It's very difficult to have a conversation with voters about any issues because the president dominates most of the conversations. And it's a visceral reaction to him personally. In these battleground swing districts, they do not like him, and it's personal.
And talk about how the issue of immigration and the president's decision then to go all in these last few days, make himself sort of the center of the last few days of the election, and make it specifically about this caravan of migrants, ending birthright citizenship, putting a video up, making appeals to voters. Basically, a fear-based appeal to voters.
That hurts our suburban races a lot. And I think it also hurts a lot of our races that have Latino majorities or large Latino populations in Florida and California and Arizona and other places. They won the election and the presidency a certain way. And I think you sometimes go back to how you won. And there is evidence that these sorts of issues do energize bases of voters in the Senate states in North Dakota and West Virginia and other places that are up for grabs for Republicans. And so I'm not saying it doesn't help there, but it really does hurt the House map. And I think we've seen the deterioration over the last week and a half.
In part as the president has focused on immigration instead of focusing on the Supreme Court or the economy or other things?
Yeah, I mean, I think our strongest argument to end this election is an economic one.
What do you guys see as you look into your crystal ball? Are both of you in the same place that Democrats win the majority on Election Day?
I think it's likelier than not, yes.
I agree with Ali. I think it's very tough for Republicans. I'm hopeful. And I hope a lot of these tied races end up breaking our way. But I feel like the current environment is making it very difficult.
Finally, do you guys have a theme song for this election?
Yeah.
Like a song that sort of sums up this year for you?
Well, unfortunately, this is embarrassing to admit, but the one that really came into my mind as soon as you said that was the Beatles' I'm So Tired.
Yeah.
That is what popped into my mind.
That's the theme for all of us this close to
what do you got, Liesl?
I'll go with that. Because I am, actually.
Right.
In every way.
In every way. Physical, emotionally, spiritually. All right. Ali and Liesl, thanks for coming in.
Thanks,
Amy.
I'm so tired, I haven't slept a wink. I'm so tired, my mind is on the blink.
We go to the Senate now, where the outlook for Democrats isn't as positive as it is in the House. The big reason for this disparity? The map. Democrats are defending a lot of red states in the Senate, many of which went for Trump in 2016 by double digits, states like Montana, North Dakota, and West Virginia. Meanwhile, Republicans are defending only one seat, Nevada, that went for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Jonathan Martin is the national political correspondent for the New York Times, and he's with us now. Hey, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Jonathan Martin, you've traveled more than I think any other political reporter I know all over this country. Can you tell us here, we're in the waning days, hours of the election, what it feels like out there and the difference between being in one of these battleground red Senate states versus being maybe in one of the battleground House races in the suburbs?
As that great American philosopher John Edwards once said, it's a story of two Americas. Yeah, it's striking. I've been in the last few weeks in North Dakota, and I've also been in the nicest part of Houston, River Oaks and the Galleria. It's just two very different views of the world, different priorities, different sensibilities when it comes to President Trump. It's almost become cliche at this point, but the politics has become nationalized. And I'm overwhelmed by it every time that I'm out there. People have moved into their competing tribes, and it does make the job somewhat more predictable, if less enjoyable.
So, Jonathan, does that mean then, if we're looking at the Senate map right now, Democrats are defending a lot of these red states that Trump carried?
Yes.
So, if we sort of look at the map today, is it then very hard to believe that, I'm going to go walk through a couple of states,
yes,
but think about Democrats in places like Missouri,
yes,
and Indiana in particular, yeah, are going to be really hard for Democrats, even if they try to carve out a path,
yeah,
that's unique to them?
Gosh, it's going to be so revealing, because if you look at the trajectory of those states in particular, you mentioned Missouri and Indiana, which are great examples, because if you think back to 2008, the reach states that President Obama carried or nearly carried were Indiana, mm-hmm, and Missouri. Indiana he just barely got, and Missouri he just barely lost. And that's not long ago. That's a decade ago. And if you look at what's happened in those states since, they've moved further and further away from the Democratic Party. And look, it was exceptional in 08 that they were as close as they were for Obama, because that was the nature of that cycle. But they are nowhere near competitive now on the presidential level. And in recent years, they haven't seemed to be that competitive for Senate races either. Think about Evan Bayh going back to Indiana, getting trounced. Even in a fantastic year and with a first-rate campaign, Jason Kander still lost to Roy Blunt in 2016 out there. And by the way, if you look at that map, and this is why Senator McCaskill is facing, yeah, a tough race in Missouri. Even in a great year with a first-rate candidate, Jason Kander only won four counties in Missouri in 2016. Four. That's it. And so the question is, with soaring Democratic enthusiasm this year, is that enough to compensate for the larger realignment in rural America? You know, Claire McCaskill is going to bring home enormous margins in St. Louis and Kansas City. She'll do really well in the suburbs around those counties. She'll win the county where Columbia is, College Town. The question is, what can she get beyond that? And you have to win some places, and you have to lose closely in others. And that's the lesson for a lot of these candidates looking back at 2016, Amy, is you can't get trounced in rural America. You don't have to win rural America, but you have to lose more closely to win statewide.
Yeah. Talk to me about Tennessee, because that's another state where you look, again, from a 30,000-foot,
yes,
view, you say, boy, this is a really Republican,
yes,
state. And yet, Democrats have a popular,
right,
former governor who sort of fits the mold,
yes,
of centrist.
Yeah.
He's running as a centrist.
Yeah.
Is that going to matter?
I spent a lot of time this fall thinking about Tennessee. I made a couple of trips down there, and I read what is for the Times a pretty darn long story about Tennessee's history and about the choice that it has this year between Marsha Blackburn and Phil Bredesen to fill the seat of Bob Corker, who is retiring. And in years past, the obvious frontrunner here and the candidate that everybody would have sort of put their money on would be Phil Bredesen. Centrist, pragmatic, former governor and mayor of Nashville, low-key, pro-business policies. He knows which fork to use for his salad. Those things kind of matter in certain precincts in Tennessee. And he would have been the sort of candidate to beat. But because of this kind of nationalization of politics that we're talking about, and because the South has become so reliably red, it's a state that is now much more Republican-leaning. And again, does that matter more than the candidates themselves? You know, Phil Bredesen is going to do really well in the two biggest cities in Tennessee, Nashville and Memphis. But what does that mean for the rest of the state? Is he going to be competitive in some of the rural counties? And again, you just look back 10 years ago at what he was able to win when he was governor of the state. Amy, when he won re-election in 06, he won every county in Tennessee. Every county in Tennessee. I think the fact that Bredesen's still competitive this late to the campaign does speak to the fact that, A, this is a good cycle for Democrats, and B, that there is some of that kind of residue left of support for sort of pragmatic leadership. But my goodness, he's done everything to stay competitive. You know, he supported Brett Kavanaugh. He's airing ads talking about his NRA A rating. He's, you know, doing inoculation on the caravan, talking sort of tough on immigration. And so he's sort of doing what it takes to stay competitive in that state. It's a good test as to whether or not that's more effective than the Beto O'Rourke approach, which is to sort of double down on who you are and just run down the line as a progressive.
So, Jonathan, speaking of Texas, yes, what is going on there with Beto O'Rourke?
Well, this has become an incredible story. I mean, he has gone from somebody who was a sort of promising House member, who was very affable figure, but not somebody who was terribly prominent in Washington, to a kind of national heartthrob, at least in progressive circles. You hear stories about people having Beto yard signs across the country.
I think there's one in my neighborhood.
Right. And he's kind of run this basically a political science experiment of, look, if I just throw the rules out and I'm going to be myself, I'm going to be authentic, I'm going to put everything on social media, and I'm not going to bow to the kind of conservative expectations of my state, I'm not going to run kind of defensive politics, I call it, right? Which is what we're talking about with Phil Bredesen, which is you try to kind of blur the lines. And so he's trying that in Texas. He's raised a ton of money for it. If you talk to the Republicans, they have their polling anywhere from 8 to 9 points less than a week out. That, by the way, is with a model of 6 million votes. And the reason why I'm getting into the weeds here on model is because the big question in Texas is who shows up, how big is the universe of voters? And this is why polling is tricky in this state, is because how do you account for who's going to show up? It's obviously going to be a big turnout, bigger than it usually is in midterm years, but how big is it going to be? The Republicans believe they have an 8 to 9 point lead. Public polling and Democratic polling have the race closer to a 4 or 5 point difference. Look, I think if you look at the early vote numbers, there's obvious enthusiasm that hasn't existed there in past midterm cycles. This is going to be, I think, a fairly competitive race. I just don't know if O'Rourke has enough strength in rural Texas to pull it off. Again, I come back to what we were talking about earlier, is Democrats can run up the score in these cities and suburbs, but you can't get blown out in rural America. And goodness knows, for those listeners out there who have driven I-10 across the country, there's a lot of rural Texas. There's a lot of rural Texas. So I think it's a competitive race. It should not be written off as sort of in hand for Cruz, but it's tough to run as an unapologetic progressive in Texas.
Tell me, as you are thinking about election night,
yeah,
what do you think the headline is that you're going to write the next day is
going
to look
like? Oh, my
gosh.
Well, I don't want to be predictive, because what's the old Larry Sabato saying? Larry Sabato says, those who live by the crystal ball end up eating glass. I think the Senate's very fluid. I can see scenarios ranging from the Republicans gaining 2 seats, maybe 3 seats on a really good day. I can also see a scenario where Democrats narrowly pick up a majority, plus one, or I can see a scenario where we're at a split, 50-50 Senate. We just don't know what's going to happen. And goodness, Nevada and Arizona, which are currently GOP-held seats, we don't know what's going to happen in Indiana and Missouri, Montana, North Dakota. Does seem to be like the Republicans are going to pick that seat up. It's just more fluid. And Amy, you know what happened in 06. It was a similar House-focused election. And I know you love House-focused election cycles because you're
yes,
you're a House kind of girl. And I love the House, too.
Yeah.
And 06 was kind of like that, too. You had big personalities, and Rahm Emanuel was there as the chairman of the Democratic Campaign Committee. There was so much scandal and action in the House. And that's what everybody was focused on. And then at the end of the campaign, there was this obvious turn of the tide that made clear that the Democrats weren't going to just win. They were going to have a thumping, as President Bush called it the day after. And all of a sudden, the Senate came online. Montana was a race with John Tester, who's up again this year. Virginia, where George Allen found himself losing to Jim Webb. And Democrats pulled out a narrow Senate majority after months and months and months of assuming that couldn't happen. So I think you can't rule anything out. There's a lot of unknowns left out there on the Senate map. So there could be some real drama on Tuesday night.
Jonathan Martin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. And you can too. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Babbel users say they're amazed at how fast they learned and that they are confident in speaking their new language. Start learning a new language today. Just go to babbel.com and use offer code TAKEAWAY to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com, offer code TAKEAWAY for 50% off your first 3 months.
Gubernatorial elections will be held in 36 states and 3 territories on November 6th. And there's a lot at stake. The winners of those races will be in a position to oversee how congressional lines are redrawn in 2020. And that has huge consequences for the balance of power in Congress and at the state legislatures. Today, we'll focus on two races that have gotten the most national attention, beginning in Florida, where former Congressman Ron DeSantis, a Republican, is running against Andrew Gillum, the Democratic mayor of Tallahassee. Adam Smith, political editor at the Tampa Bay Times, says the governor's race has divided Floridians.
I don't think we've ever had a race where it has been so partisan, and not just partisan, but the Republican candidate and the Democratic candidate are both so aggressively reaching for their bases and far less to the middle, which has been sort of the rule of thumb in Florida, that you win these elections among swing voters in the I-4 corridor, and swing voters seem scarce.
Do you see that younger voters, and especially younger voters of color, that they're turning out in a midterm year? Because they normally don't.
We always talk about how this is the year, this is Parkland, right. It's going to happen, and it never does. But I have not seen a lot of evidence that younger voters are turning out. We're sort of among the earliest to really pursue early voting, both by mail and in person in Florida. Every day you can see the partisan breakdown of who has voted and who has not. But I do think you can look at the early vote, almost 4 million votes cast, and there's not some giant Democratic wave, no question, there's not.
Is your sense that at the end of the day, the governor's race is going to be decided by just a few thousand votes? It's going to be very, very close.
I do. You know, that's become the rule of thumb almost in Florida, where if you're going to have a competitive statewide race, president, U.S. Senate, governor, it's literally a one-point race consistently over and over again. It pretty much every election cycle, when there's a very competitive race, the day after the election, the story is about Democrats across the state in the fetal position, desperately looking for another bottle of liquor and wondering what went wrong. And I think there's a reasonably good chance that'll happen this time. I think a lot of the conventional wisdom going into the throughout the primary was, and it always has been in modern history, Democrats need to nominate somebody who's a centrist, who's not going to scare business types and swing voters. And they didn't do it this time. They nominated Andrew Gillum. And in so doing, they nominated the most electrifying, interesting candidate the Democrats, I think, probably have ever nominated in the history of Florida. So I think if he loses, I think there's going to be a lot of people wondering, is the map entirely different than it used to be in Florida? I think the question for Republicans, if they lose, is going to be, I think they're going to point the finger at Trump. And you're already hearing people say that they had a presumed frontrunner, a very establishment conventional candidate, Adam Putnam, who was just assumed to be not just the Republican nominee, but the next governor. And Trump basically killed his candidacy once he endorsed DeSantis. And a lot of the establishment types think they clearly nominated the weaker candidate.
Adam, is there anything else those of us who aren't from Florida need to understand when we're looking at the results coming in from Florida on election night?
Probably like so many other places, the Democrats have been fired up like, I've been doing this a long time, like nothing I've ever seen before. If the Democrats win the governor's mansion in Florida, I wrote this today, it is an earthquake beyond anything. I mean, because the Democrats are virtually extinct in our state government. We're this neck and neck battleground state and presidential elections. But in Tallahassee, the Democrats are almost literally irrelevant. And so if they win the governor's mansion, that is a huge, huge, huge step toward rebuilding the party and turning this back into a two-party state. But that Republican side has quietly been energized. It's sort of extraordinary. I think a couple months after the presidential election, there were a lot of people petrified about what was going to happen in Florida in the election. And, you know, right now, most of these marquee races are truly a coin toss.
Adam Smith, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Amy. Appreciate it.
Now let's travel up the road a bit. Florida's neighbor to the north also has a governor's race that's attracted a lot of national attention and star power.
So I called Stacey Abrams, and I said, Stacey, this is Oprah. You know what she said? She said, girl, let me pull over to the side of the road. And I told her that I wanted to come to Georgia and lend my support. And she said, that'd be all right. That'd be just fine.
Oprah hit the campaign trail this week to support Democrat Stacey Abrams in Georgia's gubernatorial race. Abrams is running against Georgia's Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, and for voters, it's a choice between two very different candidates, a progressive Democrat or a conservative Republican. Tia Mitchell is a reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
I think both candidates did have competitive primaries, and the Georgia voters chose the most extreme candidate on each side relatively. I mean, I'm sure, you know, Stacey Abrams would say she's not that extreme. She's progressive. She wants gun control and Medicaid expansion and more funding for public education, which are kind of those true blue issues. But her opponent in the primary did kind of say, you know, I have more centrist appeal and I'll do better in the general election. And the same for the Republican side. You know, you had the lieutenant governor, Casey Cagle, and Brian Kemp, who's the Secretary of State, was the Trump guy. He was the one who was more on the extremes when it came to policies and being anti-immigration and things like that. So now there is a very clear contrast. So voters, particularly those in the center, are going to have to decide which way they will go. And I think that's tough for a lot of voters, but also that's why Kemp and Abrams really have continued to play to their base and campaign to their base. Abrams a little bit more has gone out of traditional Democratic areas, but Kemp is mostly staying in those Republican areas and really campaigning in rural Georgia where he hopes to win votes.
Is that where the race is decided? Is it if rural voters turn out and support Kemp overwhelmingly, is it the suburbs and those fast-growing Atlanta area, or is it turning out voters who traditionally don't come out in midterm elections, especially younger voters and voters of color, many of whom live in Atlanta?
That is definitely Abrams' playbook. She is trying to turn out voters who don't normally vote. She's trying to register new voters, focus on early voting and voting by mail. And again, she has traveled every county in Georgia, some of them twice. She talks about in the last week or so, she's been to over 60 counties. But her bread and butter is going to be carrying Metro Atlanta by as wide a margin as she can, because that'll help offset some of the rural red Georgia counties where Donald Trump carried counties by, you know, 60, 70, 80% in some areas.
This race has also become incredibly nationalized. It's a race for governor of Georgia. But when you look at the celebrity and the star power coming to your state, you might think that this is about a presidential campaign. Thus far, it looks like in these closing days of the campaign, Oprah Winfrey coming in for Stacey Abrams, President Obama coming in for Stacey Abrams, and then, of course, President Trump and Vice President Pence coming in for Brian Kemp, the Republican. What does that look like, and what is that doing in this race to have these big national figures coming in and getting out in front of the voters and encouraging them to vote for a certain candidate?
I think, again, this is showing that both candidates are playing to their base. Because campaigning with Donald Trump and Mike Pence, if you already weren't voting for Kemp, those rallies are not necessarily going to change your mind. And on the same way, if you're already not a fan of Stacey Abrams and you see her, you know, bringing in all these celebrities from out of town, Will Ferrell was here and Tiffany Haddish has campaigned for her and now Oprah, you might say, well, see, that's Hollywood elite. But I also, to your point, Georgia is becoming a battleground state, and particularly if Democrats can pull out some upsets on Election Day, not just with the gubernatorial race, but Congressional District 6, Congressional District 7. If they can pick up some seats in the General Assembly, I think that will further make Georgia a place that Democrats look at that is maybe not as red as people have once believed. And that will, again, as both parties start looking towards the presidential election in 2 years, they have to look at that map. They have to look at the Electoral College in Georgia. is a big state.
That's an excellent point. And I wonder, let's take the opposite outcome, that Stacey Abrams loses, Republicans hold on to those House seats. What will Democrats in the state be saying about this election? Will there be criticism about the kind of campaign that Stacey Abrams ran, that she ran too far to the left, that to win here, you need to be much more of a centrist candidate?
I definitely think if Democrats lose, it will reinforce the notion that Georgia is still pretty red and will remain red for the short term. And what that could do is cause both parties to reconsider the resources they put into Georgia going forward. I think they might start saying, we can't continue investing our money in Georgia. I think people knew who Stacey Abrams was, and so she hasn't done anything that has surprised people as far as how she's campaigning. Of course, there's always that debate about, you know, the primary system and how a lot of times the candidate on the extreme is who wins, and is that counterproductive in the general election? So, of course, there'll be those types of conversations, but they can't change the outcome of what voters chose in the primary. But again, I do think if there are not Democratic wins, the National Party may reevaluate how successful they can be in Georgia, particularly in the presidential election.
And how much will race be part of that discussion?
Race always, because Georgia, especially in Metro Atlanta, is very diverse. A lot of immigrants in Georgia, in Metro Atlanta, and again, that African-American population in Georgia. But again, that's hard statewide because, yes, there are pockets all around Georgia. You have Savannah and Augusta, but that concentration is in Metro Atlanta. And so the rest of Georgia is very different demographically speaking than Metro Atlanta. So that just makes Georgia a really interesting state politically.
Right. And the discussion about how having an African-American at the top of the ticket and what its impact was for who turned out and what the final results are will certainly be discussed regardless of the outcome.
Right. I agree. And I think it's not just about race. There's a woman at the top of the ticket and also a woman at the top of the Democratic ticket for lieutenant governor. There's also, again, the progressive platform that Stacey Abrams has pushed, you know, focusing on things. And it's, again, all the data that will come after the election to figure out what did and did not resonate with voters.
One last question, and then I'll let you get back on the trail. Georgia has this interesting rule that if you, as a candidate, do not get 50% of the vote, you go to a runoff. There's a lot of talk about the fact that this election might not be over on November 6th, and that we will see a runoff in later in November between these two candidates. How likely is it, and can you tell us how that would work?
That's right. If neither candidate gets a majority, which is, you know, 50% plus one, there would be a runoff in early December, actually, after Thanksgiving. And so that would be four more weeks of campaigning. Both campaigns are, you know, keeping that in the back of their mind. They're hoping to get to 50% so they don't have to worry about a runoff. But there is a Libertarian third party candidate that could, you know, get a few percentage points. Runoffs typically in Georgia have not been good for Democrats. You know, they spend all that energy, money and time rallying voters to get to the first election. And then it's hard to recreate that magic again the second time, knowing that, you know, Democrats always have struggled with turnout, particularly in midterms. But that is an option and it could happen.
It's really fun. Yeah, you can spend Thanksgiving on a highway somewhere in Georgia.
I'll be the one tagging the Abrams bus, and then my colleague Greg will be tagging the Kemp bus, and we'll just go wherever they lead us.
Tia Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tia Mitchell is a reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Okay, so all hour we've been talking about what's likely to happen next Tuesday, and a lot of this is based on the polls. But didn't those polls show a Hillary Clinton victory in 2016? Should we even bother to trust them this time around?
I think that people should, if not trust polls, try to understand what we're trying to do with polls. You know, we're trying to give people the best snapshot of where the country is right now with the best data that we have.
That's Claire Malone, a senior political writer at 538. And she says they've been working hard since 2016 to improve the way they model their forecasts.
What we've tried to do after 2016 is really try to make the process a bit more, you know, native to the way people think in the real world. So we changed our model from, you know, a percentage chance, you know, so-and-so has a 75% chance of winning the election. And we've switched it to so-and-so has a 1 in 6 or 3 in 4 chance of winning it. Because I actually think our brains in the real world, when we talk about, you know, gambling or odds, that's the probabilities of it. That's how we phrase it. So we've tried to be better about our presentation of probabilities in elections. But what I will say is I think we're all trying to make American news consumers smarter about the way they gather information prior to elections.
How much of this is our desire to have certainty in the world and that ultimately there is no such thing as 100% certainty?
I think that's such a good point. You know, we talk a lot about how people are so partisan in the country right now. Politics has really has permeated pop culture. It's really at the surface of American life these days. And I think whether you're Republican or Democrat, it's something you think about a lot. And so you want to know if your, you know, your team, your party is going to do well, if things are going to go your way. And I do think human beings like certainty. We like, you know, we like being able to say, well, this is the probable outcome. This is the likely outcome. And, you know, and kind of, I guess, you know, gird your loins, right? That's the thing we want to say or feel when we're going into a big event. But I think that's really right. That it's hard to sit with uncertainty in any part of your life, let alone these sweeping hundreds of races elections that do hold, you know, power years forward in American life. So I think that. Yeah, our human nature is to want a concrete answer, but it's not the way life works, unfortunately.
We keep hearing about this unprecedented turnout, mm-hmm. unprecedented early vote, mm-hmm. enthusiasm through the roof. We could see a record number of people turning out in the midterm election, maybe the highest we've seen in 100 years.
Yeah.
How much are the polls taking that into consideration, that this is not looking like your typical midterm election?
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of a tricky one for us to factor into the model. I mean, I think for the kind of conventional wisdom is that, you know, if this is a bigger turnout, then it's maybe a better for, say, the Democrats in a lot of races because their party generally is based off of a wider demographic swath of American society. So if more people are turning out, it might be better for Democratic candidates. But it is, I mean, we're also, the model is based on history and the way that people have acted in previous elections. So I think the idea that this could be, you know, we've looked at fundraising. There's been a huge, huge surge in fundraising on the Democratic side of things. You know, we try to take that stuff into account in our model. Early voting, we're a little bit wary of because we're not sure who the people who are early voting are voting for. We can only tell their party registration, but people sometimes cross party lines, as we found out in the last couple of elections. I think the idea that this could be a massive turnout is really, really interesting because it could potentially activate the people who are super anti-Trump, the hashtag resistance people. They could come out in big swaths, you know, minorities in states like Georgia and Florida could be really excited about their historic gubernatorial nominees. But then on the other hand, you could get a really big surge of turnout of that really enthusiastic Trump base who's really responding to his basically, let's say, last week to 10 days of the campaign where he's really doubling down on his anti-immigrant message. And so we're kind of left with this, well, I don't know, who's this big historic turnout gonna swing for? And I guess that's where I would say that's what makes election night kind of exciting, is that we're all, you know, we've all spent, I guess, the better part of 2 years trying to figure out how Americans are going to react to the past 2 years of American life on November 6th. And we'll see.
How are you approaching the exit polls this year?
The caution with exit polls is that on election night, they give us an interesting snapshot of states and potentially demographics. although they can be a little bit wrong, you know, if you're you know, digging into them in the next couple of weeks and months, sometimes they can be a bit off. So we certainly will, on our election night live blog, be talking about exit polls and trying to give readers a good snapshot of what we think is happening. But I also think, you know, the fun thing, or however you want to think about it, about elections is that, you know, the next couple of weeks after the election happens, that's when we really start to dig into the data and figure out bigger trends and try to, I guess, synthesize for people what's happening. But I think it's safe to say that we will be using exit polls on election night to give ourselves an idea of what's happening. Who's turning out? Who are those, you know, who's swinging for? Are those college-educated white women swinging for Republicans or Democrats? You know, things like that. We will certainly trying to be use exit polls as a barometer for the electorate with a little bit of caution.
Claire, tell us what the 538 forecasts are in the Senate and the House right now.
Sure. In the Senate, the Democrats don't have a very good chance of taking back the chamber. We're giving them about a 1 in 7 shot of doing that. So pretty long odds for them. In the House, we're giving Democrats a 6 in 7 chance of taking back the House. So it's really interesting because our forecast is basically split. And I should mention that we also have a governor's forecast model, and we are predicting that Democrats will end up governing more of the American population. So it's interesting that we're seeing this split between the House of Representatives and the Senate, and I think it's, you know, I've talked about this before, I think it's sort of it has interesting echoes to the 2016 split between the popular vote and the Electoral College. Republicans in 2018 have a structural advantage, I would say, in the Electoral College and in the Senate this year, because they do better in these more rural areas, more rural states, and in the Senate. A small state and a big state have the same number of seats, the same power. So it is a really interesting split that we're seeing, and something that, you know, is actually kind of rare. So that makes it exciting, I think.
Claire Malone, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
You can get with this, or you can get with that. You can get with this, or you can get with that. You can get with this, or you can get with that. I think you can get with this. This is where it's at.
For months now, we've been hearing from pundits and politicians that this is the most consequential midterm election of our lifetimes. So I want to end today's show by talking about what exactly is at stake. According to President Donald Trump, he may not be on the ballot, but the fate of his agenda is.
A Democrat victory on Election Day would be a bright, flashing invitation to traffickers, smugglers, drug dealers, and gang members all over the world. Come on in.
In the final days of the campaign, the president has ramped up rhetoric on illegal immigration. He's ordered the military to protect the southern border as a caravan of Central American migrants moves north.
Anybody throwing stones, rocks, like they did to Mexico and the Mexican military, Mexican police, where they badly hurt police and soldiers of Mexico, we will consider that a firearm.
He's also promoting an end to birthright citizenship with an executive order.
It was always told to me that you needed a constitutional amendment.
Right. Guess what? Amendment.
You don't. Number one, you don't need that. Number two,
I mean, that's in dispute.
You could definitely
that's very much in dispute.
Well, you can definitely do it with an act of Congress, but now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order.
And then on Wednesday, President Trump released a video on Twitter reminiscent of the infamous Willie Horton attack ad used in the 1988 presidential election.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, please step out of the hallway.
Break up soon, and I'll kill more.
He says he wants to apply for pardon for the felony he committed. Attempt of murder.
The text underneath this video reads, "Illegal immigrant, Luis Bracamontes killed our people. Democrats let him into our country. Democrats let him stay." It's not very subtle. It should come as no surprise that in places where Trump is popular, Republican candidates have put this issue front and center in their campaigns.
A caravan of 14,000 illegal immigrants is marching on America. But Phil Bredesen?
A few thousand very poor people is not a threat.
Phil Bredesen, dangerously wrong for Tennessee.
The caravan is full of gang members and criminals. Who is tough enough to secure our border? Not Dan Feehan.
Even some Democrats in deep red states, like Senator Joe Donnelly of Indiana, are embracing issues like the border wall and a continued funding for ICE.
The radical left wants to eliminate ICE.
I support ICE and funding President Trump's border wall.
But in many of the suburban districts that will control the balance of power in the House, the issue isn't immigration or even Trump himself. For Republicans, the focus is Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
When you get Elaine Luria, you get Nancy Pelosi. Package deal.
In Washington, Feehan would vote with Pelosi for open borders and amnesty, putting Minnesota families at risk.
Nancy Pelosi back in power. Gridlock. And then impeachment. Is that really what you want?
While many voters in these districts may not embrace the president or his rhetoric, Republicans believe that Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic agenda are even more toxic than Donald Trump. Meanwhile, in most Democratic ads, Trump's name doesn't come up at all. Instead, there's been a laser-like focus on one issue.
I don't know why you voted to let insurance companies go back to denying coverage for pre-existing conditions, but I know Heidi would never do that.
I'm Heidi Heitkamp, and I approve this message.
Now the threat is Patrick Morrissey's lawsuit to take away health care from people with pre-existing conditions.
I'm Ellen Lipton. I approve this message because, to me, the health care fight isn't new, but it is personal.
I'm Claire McCaskill, and I approve this message because the insurance companies already have too many senators on their side.
Obamacare is more popular today than it has been since the law was passed in 2010. A big reason for its newfound popularity was the attempt by Republicans in Congress to repeal the law last year. Democrats aren't spending much time defending Obamacare, but they are attacking Republicans for voting to undermine one of the most popular aspects of the law, protections for pre-existing conditions. Of course, there's another voice that looms large over this election.
I am here to ask you to vote in what might be the most important election of our lifetimes. The stakes really are that high. The consequences of anybody sitting out of this election are profound.
After staying out of the spotlight for most of Trump's tenure, President Barack Obama is making a high-profile return to the campaign trail to provide a closing argument to voters about the importance of electing Democrats.
And as a fellow citizen, not as an ex-president, but as a fellow citizen, I'm here to deliver a simple message, and that is that you need to vote because our democracy depends on it.
Now, in previous midterm years, when he was in the White House, Obama's pleas to his coalition, those younger voters and voters of color, to get to the polls didn't succeed. Will they turn out this year? As for me, I've been focused on this election since, well, pretty much the day after the 2016 election ended. I'm not normal, I know, but this is my job. To me, the most remarkable takeaway from this election is how little things have changed since 2016. The coalition that brought Trump to the White House, white, older, rural, and overwhelmingly male voters, continue to give him high marks. Meanwhile, those who voted against him in 2016, women, college-educated white voters, voters of color, dislike him as much today as they did back then. And these opinions of the president color the way voters see the race for Congress. In red rural America, the battleground for the Senate, Trump remains popular, which gives Republicans the opportunity to pick off a seat or two from Democrats currently holding those states. I'm thinking of places like North Dakota, Missouri, and Indiana. But in purple or blue-leaning America, the suburbs around major metropolitan areas like Denver, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and Chicago, Trump is deeply unpopular. With so many battleground districts in and around these places, Democrats are favored to pick up control of the House. Another way to think of this, the battle for control of the Senate and the House are taking place in two very different countries. And on election night, both sides may be able to claim victory. So while we don't know exactly what will happen on Tuesday, one thing that does look certain is that America on November 7th, 2018, is likely to look as divided and polarized as it did the day after the election in 2016. And the fate of the election means a lot to many of you, the voters, who will get your chance next Tuesday to have your voice heard.
This is Heather from the Twin Cities of Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Alina from Arlington, Texas.
My name's Fred Brinkley.
This is Jason Farbaugh. I'm calling from North Wales.
Pennsylvania.
My name is Jacqueline Thomas. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon.
This is Joel from Normal, Illinois. I am voting in these midterm elections because I would like my voice to be heard by the representatives in Washington.
I think what's at stake is getting key people like senators who will stand up for human rights.
Equal pay for women, health care, the absolute right to vote is all in jeopardy.
This is the last best chance to wrest control of the federal government from the Republicans. I'm a moderate Republican, and I think they've done a bad job.
What's at stake, in my opinion, is a rejection of the negative, prejudiced, violent tendencies our country's moving to.
Am I voting? Hell yes, I'm voting. Living in Minnesota, it's a huge year for us. The governor's up for election, 2 Senate seats, and a highly contested representative seat, plus the attorney general. There's no way I would not vote this year. Please, everybody, vote.
What's your choice?
Be sure to tune in next week and join us as we process the results of the election and talk about what comes next. Leadership elections in the House, a possible government shutdown, and of course, 2020. And remember, you can always find us on Facebook and leave a comment there or send us a tweet. I'm at Amy E. Walter and the show is at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Amy Walter. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by YouTube Originals and Roadside Attractions, presenting Viper Club, starring Susan Sarandon as a mother struggling to free her captured journalist son. Also starring Matt Bomer and Edie Falco, in theaters Friday.
Tell me who you